Café Rollist is your caffeinated tabletop RPG break. It started as our exclusive Patreon show, but following a survey with our supporters, I am happy now to share its most recent episode here with you. If you enjoy this show, please consider checking out our archive of 100 or so additional episodes, which are still exclusive on Patreon.
Welcome to a new Café Rollist as part of our series Road to Session Zero Con, which is almost upon us. It's next weekend on January 30th. And today I'm joined by someone not from the Philippines or Malaysia, a little bit further, from Korea. Bam, could you introduce yourself?
Hi, everybody. My name's Bam Lee. I'm a Korean-American artist, writer, and game designer, currently living in South Korea, in Seoul, where I was originally born, but I did not grow up here. I grew up in the U.S. I moved back here in my 20s, and I've been living here ever since.
Great. We got a couple ice-breaking questions, because this is a spin-off from my main show, which was born out of the COVID situation. What's your routine like at the moment? Is it impacted in any way by the ongoing thing?
Me personally, not a whole lot. I do a number of different things, mostly freelancing as a editor or writer sometimes. I also run a craft business with my wife. So we teach, my wife teaches macrame classes here in South Korea. So I help her with that business as well. We run the business together. In terms of some things, in terms of our business has been impacted, like live classes, or in my case, I used to run a lot of in-person D&D games at my local game store. But since COVID, I've moved all of those games online. And at first, I thought that would be quite difficult for me because I've always just done tabletop games in person rather than any sort of online games. But I found that there are, I think, different merits to the different kinds of gaming. And I've come to enjoy the online aspect of it quite a bit. So I've been, since COVID started, I've been running an online game on a weekly basis.
Yeah, it's the same for me, actually. I quite fancy playing online. It's not the same experience. Like, lately, we were baking at home, and we don't see anyone. We haven't seen anyone till well before the end of last year. So when we're baking, we used to bake as part of having our tabletop game. So we would bake something and share it with friends. So we miss that part. But when it comes to playing or running games online, I actually like it very much. I think I'll probably continue afterwards. I'll have games around the tables now and then also, but I think most of my games will remain online.
One thing that I really appreciate about online play is being able to play with people in other countries as well. Before COVID started, I started a game with some exchange students from France. Oh. And due to COVID, they moved back to France. And I've and we continued playing together. One of the players is still playing with us on a sort of semi-regular basis. So he's working now. He can't play all the time, but occasionally he does join us, despite the time difference. But he does join us from time to time.
I need to ask you more questions about those friends afterwards, because I'm trying to find French players, French TTRPG enthusiasts who've been a bit around the world, so they can share their experience. Did you get introduced to Dungeons & Dragons while you were in the US or in Korea?
I mean, I always knew about it in the US. The first time I played was during, I think it was middle school or high school, but we only played a couple of games before it sort of fizzled out. I was actually sort of reintroduced to it through my ex-girlfriend, who's Korean, who turned out to be a huge D&D nerd. So she introduced me to her friends. And when I was in Korea for a year on a research grant, I played D&D with her and her friends pretty regularly. And that was one of the things that actually helped me relearn the Korean language.
Oh, wow.
Because at the time, I couldn't really speak Korean. I could understand a little bit because my parents always spoke Korean in the household when I was growing up. But I always spoke back to them in English. But now here I was in a situation where I was kind of forced to speak. Well, not forced to speak, where I wanted to speak and understand more. So it was like really sort of an advanced level speaking class for about a year.
Yeah, I actually know someone in Malaysia, Keru Isham. He teaches English using role-playing games. He is more fond of Star Wars, but he teaches kids English. So I think tabletop role-playing is has a lot of potential to practice a language. In Germany, the most popular game is The One Ring. In the US, of course, it's Dungeons & Dragons. I've heard that in Japan, Call of Cthulhu is the most popular tabletop role-playing game. What is it like in Korea? Is it sort of balanced? Is it one game which rules them all? What does the community likes to play?
So I'm sort of partly involved in the Korean tabletop community here. But I'd say I'm probably a little more involved with like some of the expat communities more so. So I'm probably not the best person to ask about like an overall view of the Korean tabletop scene. Although I'd say from my perspective, it seems like D&D is quite popular, but maybe Call of Cthulhu is a bit more popular or a bit more widespread. That game store I mentioned is run by a friend of mine named Joey, who's from the States. And he mentioned the story to me where someone came in asking for a Call of Cthulhu dice. And it took him a long time to realize that the person probably just meant polyhedral dice for gaming. And they just referred to it as Call of Cthulhu because that was their point of reference for tabletop games. Now, I'm not saying that you know everyone's like that, but I think... outside of the U.S., especially, Call of Cthulhu seems pretty broadly, popular internationally. In some places, I think more so than D&D. D&D here certainly has its fandom. There is Adventures League here among the Korean community as well. But I think maybe Call of Cthulhu has had better. Maybe better translated books, I'm not really sure, but just more maybe official support or published support for a longer period of time.
I'm being told by Sangjun in the chat room, I hope I pronounced that correctly, that yet again I got a connection issue. So I'm going to turn off my camera, but I'm still here. There you go. Okay. So at some point you made the jump to writing tabletop RPG adventures and maybe some games too. How did that happen? What brought you to this?
So I think it was sort of a gradual process. So I've been keeping a website where I write campaign journals of the adventures I run, which include published adventures and also homebrew adventures that I made, mostly in the Eberron setting because it's my favorite Dungeons & Dragons setting. I think that got me practiced with writing a little bit more, writing down my ideas and my interpretations of different hardcover adventures and thinking about the possibilities of where those stories could go. And then this year, I started trying to run games for more people, because a friend invited a friend invited, you know how it happens, right? And then suddenly I had like too many people that I couldn't all run games for at the same table. So, I had kind of a crazy idea. Why don't I get another DM to run the same adventure with me, an adventure that I make? But then I realized in order to do that, I have to actually write the module for them to, you know, run the game off of. And that got me like practiced with, that gave me a chance to practice writing a module for someone else to run. And I think that was a really good experience for me, which might be a little different from, you know, say if I just had an idea for a module that I wanted to write and just publish somewhere for an anonymous audience. I mean, I had a chance here to write an adventure that I knew was going to be run by someone in a week.
Oh, wow. Cool.
And so, yeah, and so I had to, you know, and some of it involves feedback with the DM that I that would be running that adventure, because it was like on a rotating basis. I had a group of DMs who were willing to try out this crazy idea. So that gave me a really good chance to, you know, get feedback and sort of figure out what areas were kind of weak or needed improvement. So I think that helped a lot. And those became some of the first adventures I published on the Dungeon Masters Guild. So the first ones that I made were called The Branches of Time, which is a series of time travel adventures set in the world of Eberron.
Cool. You said you're not that integrated in the Korean community. What about in South Korea? It seems that in the US there's a Asian community which is growing more vocal, which is a great thing, through shows like Asian Represents and other initiatives. Do you engage a lot of with Asians and Koreans back in the US or in the US?
I mean, not in the US so much. I actually used to run bilingual games in Korea. So I'd run games with half Korean players, like Korean players, and then the other half were American players. And one of my freelancers, I mentioned I do a couple of different jobs, is I also work as a freelance interpreter now, mainly for film and animation festivals, because I studied animation in university. Sort of using some of those skills, I ran these bilingual games where the players didn't have to all be bilingual. They didn't have to speak English and Korean. One side would speak Korean, the other side would speak English. And I would I would translate between them during the game, which was, I really enjoyed it personally. I enjoyed the fact that I was able to be sort of like, this might sound kind of cheesy, but sort of a bridge between people across a language barrier, people who otherwise really wouldn't be playing Dungeons and Dragons together, and creating an opportunity for people to play the game together, you know, across that language gap. And, you know, for Koreans who wanted to maybe learn a little, practice their English a little more, and expats who wanted to pick up some more Korean, there are expats here who've been here for a number of years, for a long time. Korean's actually quite good, but I think they maybe don't always have an opportunity to speak Korean with Koreans, because a lot of times they're here working as English teachers, where their job is to speak English, to engage their students in English. So I think they enjoyed that aspect of it as well.
Yeah, you're entirely right, and it's kind of a situation you see in a lot of countries. I mean, I was an Anglophile before I moved to London, but when you move here, through, you know, circumstances, you tend to be surrounded by other expats and immigrants rather than locals, and tabletop role-playing is definitely one of the few opportunities, contexts where you can easily engage with locals. It's amazing that you make that translation bridge. I was just editing an interview with someone from Quebec in French Canada, and they were explaining how some of their table run in both French and English, and sometimes the players don't understand one another, but it becomes an element in the story. Did you make that an element in the story? Like, I don't know, some of them would be from different nations in the games, and that's how you sort of dealt with the translation challenge?
I didn't actually. I've seen that done by another game master for like a one-shot game where that was. So he ran a game where he had two groups of players from two different language groups, and they were sort of they began as players or their characters began as being on opposite sides of a conflict, but then they eventually have to work together. And he made that kind of interesting, but I never really did that too much personally. The benefit that I found from running a bilingual game was that it actually gave me more time to think. Since I'm saying everything twice, basically, it gives me a chance to say it once and then sort of reorganize my thoughts a little bit as I'm speaking the second time. And I guess it kind of gave me a chance to buy more time in a natural way. When I went back to playing just like, running games in English for just a single language table, I found that I kind of missed that aspect of running a bilingual game, just having that extra bit of time. But I don't think it really slowed down the game too much for the players. At least that's the feedback I got from some of the players I asked. Do you feel like it slows the game down too much? Or do you feel like you're not, enjoying it as much as a single language game? And for the most part, I think it didn't really feel that way, I hope.
I know in French, we like to translate, for instance, the names of the creatures in Dungeons & Dragons. So we've got Tiranoi for Beholder. And meanwhile, in Portugal, apparently, they don't bother doing that. They hate actually translating stuff. So they just say, they speak in Portuguese, and in the middle of the sentence, there's the word beholder. Do you have words for creatures in Korean, or do you just use the English ones?
So again, I'm not. I don't actually have the Korean D&D 5th edition book. I have the starter set. I got the starter set when they were doing the crowdfunding for that. And I really should pick up the core books. But I think in terms of the monsters, what I'm aware of is that they did translate a lot of the monsters. And maybe I think there maybe were some that they didn't. So it was kind of back and forth. I know that for the class names, they transliterated everything. So they just called a fighter a fighter. I'm kind of more used to an older... I think translation system, maybe, because the first people I played with were I think they described themselves kind of like as like the first generation Korean D&D nerds. My dungeon master was he was at one point a game designer by trade as well, and he started playing D&D like in the 90s when friends would like bring books over from the States, and they were all just like figuring out how to do it at the time. And they didn't have any dice. So they told me they like folded their own polyhedral dice out of paper and rolled those.
Wow.
And like sort of crazy stories like that. And they had they made their own translations as well. Like they translated and bound their own books so that they could play Dungeons & Dragons. And a lot of those older translations that they made translated those classes and a lot of other things too. I think that's one thing that I need to be better about in terms of if I play with Korean players again, to try to be more on top of like the terminology in Korean that they might be used to, rather than just kind of leaning on the terms that I'm used to.
So going back to your work, I see on the Dungeon Masters Guild website, and I will link it in the description of the episode so people can purchase it. And if they do with this link, I will get a few cents so people can support my show. But I see Riders of the Cyclops, Saving Salvation, A Crimson Carol, The Lover's Potion, I think it's you also. Which one would you recommend people should rush towards? Which one is your favorite, you would say?
I think I like all of those just for different reasons. The one that I'm running at session zero is Riddles of the Cyclopes. And all of the adventures I have up on the Dungeon Masters Guild right now are Eberron adventures or Eberron compatible, including Riddles of the Cyclopes. So Riddles of the Cyclopes I wrote when the Theros book, when Mythic Odysseys of Theros was coming out. And I wanted to try writing something that could be used in multiple settings. So, you know, on the 10, it's about riddles and involves a cyclopes, or a cyclops rather. The cyclopes, the plural, refers to a cyclops and other one-eyed creatures. And so you could play it as sort of a generic, maybe kind of Greek-themed game, whether it's set in the Theros setting or not. But it also has more specific adventure hooks and conclusions for Theros, the Forgotten Realms, and also for the Eberron setting.
So at session zero, so you're gonna run, are you gonna run several sessions of the same scenario or just one? Are you gonna have a booth? What are your plans for this weekend there?
So I'm actually going to be kind of going back and forth between two booths. One is Riddles. One is my own booth where I'll be running one session of Riddles of the Cyclopes. The other is a booth for a small community of Korean tabletop game designers or up-and-coming designers, people who are just kind of getting into tabletop game design right now. So this is a completely online community. They are right now working on a series of small adventures, small one-page adventures called one-page dungeons. So it's, the idea is that the whole dungeon can fit on a single printable page. I'm going to be running one of the one-page dungeons written by one of the other members in this community. And the community is called the RPG Creators Club.
I know yourself, you're not on Twitter, but, you know, RPGC, they made themselves noticeable over there on Twitter. Is this group or any other Korean group have a Twitter hashtag like RPGC? Or if someone is looking for Korean creators, they should look at RPG as well? Because RPGC, Southeast Asia, as far as I understand, Korea is not exactly in Southeast Asia.
Right. Yeah. So, for the RPG Creators Club, I did make a website for the community, but mainly it's just a placeholder at the moment. It's something that that we're working on, and we need to develop some more. At the moment, it's all in Korean, partly because one of my goals for this was to actually try to create more Korean language content, Due to this opportunity with Session Zero, I will be putting some English text on there just as an explanation of what this project is, what this community is. But I'm hoping that this community will be kind of a way for Korean designers to create more original content in the Korean language. Because there's a lot of tabletop content in Korea, but a lot of it is translated, a lot of translated games, translated from English or from, Japanese. There are a lot of JRPGs here as well. I have not seen a lot of, Korean language, original tabletop content. One notable exception is an independent game designer named Sangjun, who actually has recently signed up for a booth at Session Zero. So you'll be seeing him there as well. And he recently crowdfunded a very nice tabletop game called Moonflower, which is based on tarot cards, so tarot. So he, takes inspiration from the major arcana of tarot, sort of created a game based on that. I think the game that he is going to be showcasing at Session Zero will probably be another game, so it will not be that. But that is a very nice game. I think I have that here actually. I'm plugging another author right now at this point. Sorry about that. But
yeah, actually, so Sanjun is in the chat room and he's very very happy that you.
here you go, Sanjun. Here's your plug. So this is a very nice book. I mean, and the artwork in this is really lovely as well. So yeah, my cat wants to see it too. So yeah, I won't show you the whole thing. You'll have to
gorgeous have
to find it and buy it if possible. But yeah, it's really nice. The rules, as you can see, are it's in English and Korean, which I think is amazing. I mean, that's just amazing, amazing.
That's great. It's interesting that apparently there's not such a big tabletop RPG creator scene in Korea, because, you know, I always see TTRPG like an extension of popular culture to some extent. So France, they got their thing going on. So they got their own TTRPG. The UK, they got that. And Korea, you are such a... I mean, from the outside, you look like such a powerhouse of entertainment, especially today. You've got cinema, you've got TV with K-drama, you got K-pop, which is really thriving. So there's definitely something missing there if there's no... By the way, Sangjun was suggesting to start using the hashtag KTRPG, I think. Is it 20?
Oh, that'd be nice.
That'd be nice. So yeah, that would be awesome to have more of it, but it's surprising that there's not so much yet, or at least you're not aware of it.
I think it's more that I'm probably not aware of it, honestly. And when I show you this, I'm specifically talking about things that are published and, you know, more widely accessible, published systems, published adventures and things. People certainly do write adventures and do run lots of really creative, really original content. I think a lot of it is more confined to like online communities, and so it's a lot of it is what you might call just homebrew rather than indie game publications. So I think that's one difference. Like one of the things that I'm trying to do with the that hope will be possible with the RPG Creators Club is to create more published, like specifically published content, and to kind of show that hey, this is something that you could potentially try to do for a living if you're really passionate about it. I know it's difficult even for like English speaking or English writing creators on the Dungeon Master Guild to make a living off of that or to pursue that full time even. I do know that there are people who do it, even if it's difficult. So, and there's certainly, beyond that space even, or just like the wider, there's just so much, publishing and so much great work being put out there that I'd like to see more of that kind of, more of those publishing publications coming out of Korea as well, and just reaching like a wider audience rather than, staying within just like the Korean internet sphere.
Yeah, we had a whole panel dedicated about how do you find your space online and on the global stage, which is English speaking, when your community itself, you sort of, it really feels like, and I think that's what's happening with RPGC, it really feels like you need to develop a strong, robust local community, and then it can become a platform to try to reach out to the outside, but you need to sort of find your own market home before you're able to. I know also, right now, we've got, there's a Kickstarter for All Shores, which supports three projects from the Philippines and Malaysia on Kickstarter. But I know that, at least from the Philippines, it's actually illegal to use Kickstarter. Do you know if there are similar crowdfunding platforms in Korea and if it's actually legal for Koreans to use the American platform?
I think there's no issue of it being illegal or anything. I think it's the challenge is more an issue of maybe like transferring funds between American platforms and Korean ones. So there's a Korean counterpart to Kickstarter, which is called Tumblebug, and a lot of creators use Tumblebug to crowdfund projects. Moonflower was crowdfunded through Tumblebug as well.
Oh, okay.
Translations are crowdfunded through that as well. The D&D 5th edition translations were crowdfunded through Tumblebug, I believe, and other projects as well.
So each time I've got a guest who's really into D&D, it's kind of my classic question to ask. Have you tried other systems and maybe Korean systems or systems you think you would like to develop with in the future?
I've looked at other systems and I feel like it's kind of a failing on my part, honestly, that I have not run a lot of games or explored a lot of other systems. I've run like different variations or different editions of D&D, but Call of Cthulhu, which is quite similar in terms of like the basic raw mechanics and stuff. I actually have not run a lot of other different systems, which I hope at at some point I can rectify. But yeah, I mean, I guess I'm just very, very used to D&D, and I feel like there are a lot of, you can do a lot of things with any system, really, and it's just a matter of how you use the tools at your disposal, I suppose. And the other thing is like the community of the people around you. I think, the people that I play with, the friends that I play with. They all enjoy D&D. They all enjoy Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition. I'm always open to trying new things at some point, but yeah, just always kind of wondering when that will be.
That's the thing right now, with moving online, that's also an opportunity to try new games in much easier fashion. If you want to run them, it's easier because you have more chances to find players. And if like me, you like to run games, but you're very lazy when it comes to learning systems or even just reading the most basic book. So what I do is I join games. I learn the game by playing it, mainly at the Gauntlet. But like at the beginning of the year, I made a call for a couple games, including Brindlewood Bay, which I really recommend. I don't know if you know the show Murder, She Wrote. You play old ladies investigating, and it's spoiled by the apocalypse. It's very simple. It's very simple, yet at the same time, to counter what you were saying, it really achieves things that you cannot do with Call of Cthulhu or Dungeons & Dragons. So you don't have all your rules to do everything, but what it does, it really makes the experience specific and special. So I learned that one online, and now I'm probably going to try to do my own hack. Very soon, in February, again, there's an open community day, gaming community day at the Gauntlet. So if you want to try anything, there are a lot of stuff on offer, and they're never stuff for which you need to need the rules in advance. Usually the game master teach you everything you need to know. Are there other projects you wish to discuss or topics, since I'm running out of questions?
I guess going back to why I don't run other systems. If I'm being like really kind of brutally honest, the big part of it is laziness on my part. But another issue is, really is time, especially since I started writing adventures. I found that, you know, like time is such a precious resource. Like dividing time between, you know, making a living, doing other work, but also trying to write adventures and trying to, you know, prep and run adventures. And it's just, you know, sometimes it's tough. It's tough juggling so many things. And you know, like if you're doing like a broadcast like this, I'm sure, you know, this also, for someone like yourself, this also takes, you know, a lot of preparation and, you know, time organizing things and, you know, getting people to, you know, come on the show. So it's, you know, it's tough juggling, you know, so many different things.
Yeah, it is. But you know, the thing is with D&D, which sometimes people are missing, it's designed that way. You know, it's an ecosystem, so it's made to capture you and keep you. It's like, if you compare it to something different, it's like if you start buying Apple products or Samsung products or Androids, it's all designed in a way which tells you, no, stay with us. And well, yeah, when you play D&D or a big game like that, not that other games are smaller, but yeah, it's almost intentionally complicated. So it feels like everything would be as complicated to get on board to, which is not quite true. And again, D&D is there, and the community is there to keep you inside and tell you, oh, well, you want to play something, you want to play a heist? Well, here's Dragon Heist. You don't need to try Blades in the Dark. You can play that in 5e, which is not entirely true. But I think there's really a big difference in terms of, and again, it's designed this way by Wizards. As soon as you have tried a couple other games and you realize that actually it's not that much work, especially if you're not the game master, once you try the second one, it's much easier to try a third one and so on. I mean, I had the experience at a club here. I was running an old version of Star Wars D6, which is really simple, and had players ahead of the session asking me, okay, where's the player's handbook? Or what rules do I need to read? And I was like, I never read anything before joining any of the 100 games I played, because I would not be playing anything. So, but when you play D&D, it feels like that you will need to learn all these things all over again to learn a new system. And Call of Cthulhu is a bit like that also. I'm preparing for a Call of Cthulhu stream at the moment, but really, most games you can trust the game master to do what you need to.
Yeah, that is very true. All the things that you're saying right now, it's very, very true.
It's not a criticism. I know it's always comes across as judgmental or snobbish when I recommend to try other games, but it's, I mean, there's stuff like Brendan Woodbury, for instance, came up with a brilliant idea for resolving investigations. And you know, if you played this little game once, you can even come back to Dungeons and Dragons or Call of Cthulhu and say, well, I could run things a bit like that. I could take these rules and use it for D&D. So in Brendanwood Bay, the way the investigations work, you know, the issue when you play something, you've seen the movie Sherlock Holmes and you're like, oh, that is so good. I'm going to run that in a role-playing game. And you lay your clues. Your players miss half the clues, and then even if they have 7 clues, none of us is Sherlock Holmes. So you got 7 clues and you have no idea what's going on. Well, what I really like with Brindlewood Bay is that the idea is, so the game is to find the clues, you find the clues, but actually the game master has not decided who's the killer, for instance, if someone's got killed. What happened is that the players, they all got all their clues together, they come up with a theory, and based on the number of clues they have in their theory, they make a roll, they got a bonus, the more clues they use, and then you find out if their theory is right or wrong. But The game master did not decide that in advance. You discover it. So, and that's something you could do in Dungeons and Dragons. And that's just an example. Inventory in Blades in the Dark, for instance. I don't want my inventory to be like any other game than Blades in the Dark. No, you don't decide what's in your inventory. You know that you've got a list and you can tick things on your list and you got a maximum of ticks you can do in your list. But during the game, you decide, oh, I had the rope. And there's a flashback where you fetch the rope. But so, yeah, there's stuff like that, which I think would benefit Dungeons & Dragons. So, yeah, that's why I'm trying to always advocate for that.
Yeah. And you're very right that, you know, they do create, like, you know, these ecosystems that are kind of, like, all-encompassing, I suppose. I think in terms of writing for, you know, the Dungeon Masters Guild or like Miskatonic Repository or those sorts of community, you know, writing programs, that's what you kind of end up, you know, you tend to lean into that more so. Like you lean into those communities and try to, you know, write things that, you know, would appeal to them or you think might appeal to them or at least appeal to yourself as like a member of one of those communities. So I suppose on the one hand, it is like, you know, like they're kind of keeping you in the system, plugged into the system. But, you know, on the other hand, I think there is like the community aspect of it as well, or like feeling like you're part of like the larger community. I guess it's a matter of perspective.
Yeah, it's sort of carrot and stick, and it's so the Dungeon Master Guild is a good example of that. It's like, no, you don't need to go on drive-thru and be exposed to other games, just stay here, and it will be all D&D just for you, and no, you don't need to go sell your D&D adventure elsewhere, just stay here, and we'll support you, but this way, you stay here, and the people you attract, they stay here as well, and we all great right here. Why go see elsewhere? Why go on itch.io or drive through or you don't need to just stay close to me. Here's a little program with a badge so you I got Richard from the D20 Future Show who asks what's your sort of process when you design an adventure? Do you come up with an arc and then fill it up, or you start from the beginning, or do you have an idea? Or how did you sort of write your adventure so far?
I think it's been different for each adventure. So one of the first adventures I sort of wrote, or rather came up with, but didn't actually write down, was a lover's potion. And that was for a Valentine's Day one-shot. And that game was kind of what got me back into running games at like a local game store after a long hiatus. So this, despite the what the title might suggest, it's not mainly about a love potion, although there is an element of that. I know that is kind of a controversial issue, but it's more about a certain alchemist and like the terrible mistake that he makes, and the adventure is more about, you know, kind of dealing with the mess that he makes. But yeah, so for that it kind of ran the game, and then much later I sat down and actually thought, okay, if I was going to write this as an adventure, how would I write it? Because when I ran it, a lot of it was very improvisational. I was kind of you know, like what you were saying before about the mystery, running a mystery game, I was kind of leaning into the player's assumptions and their guesses. So, you know, at one point, I actually hadn't really fleshed out the villain of the story when I was running the game, but one of the players suggested, based on the way that I was describing him, I thought maybe he was like some sort of zombie or something, but one of the players said maybe he's a warforged, like he's a sentient construct. I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. So maybe he is a warforged. And then the story sort of developed based around that. So that's one thing that I made sure to include in the published adventure, that the nature of the villain is kind of open-ended, or can be open-ended. That's something that Dungeon Master can set out at the beginning, but it's also something that they can kind of, you know, improvise along the way. Because for the most part, this kind of a spoiler, but for the most part, you don't really see the villain's identity until towards the end. So that's kind of a reveal, but it's something that the Dungeon Master could, while they're running, before they're running the game, have decided in advance, or something that they could, you know, let the players determine for themselves. Some of my other adventures, I tried to sort of write from the ground up. One of the products I wrote for the Eberron Adventures League is called Saving Salvation. It's actually a series of three shorter adventures that are designed to be salvage missions or adventures that you can kind of plug into like the main Adventures League campaign. Since that's one of the community writing programs, and it's within the Dungeon Master's Guild, like writing salvage missions for the Eberron Adventures League campaign. So those were designed with a specific objective in mind, having these as you know being salvage missions that are kind of more modular or things that they can be incorporated into the larger campaign. And as I described earlier, the time travel adventures I wrote, those I wrote specifically. I actually had run those as homebrew adventures first, but then when I was running those adventures again for a new group of people and with a second dungeon master each time, helping me run for a larger group of people, I was specifically writing with that in mind, trying to write something that would be runnable and enjoyable by the group of people that I'm playing with right now.
So you are comfortable with the concept of Quantum Augur when you game mastering or playing something?
The concept of what?
Quantum Augur. So I'm not sure how popular this image is, but the idea of a Quantum Augur for when you are game mastering. So if you're picturing a room in a dungeon and there's three doors, sort of a sandbox approach would say, well, door A, you got a treasure. Door B, you've got a trap. Door C, you got an ogre. So that's sandbox. Everything is defined in advance. Railroad E is to say, well, I want to open door A. Oh, you cannot open the door. I try. No, you can't. Oh, I try door B. You can't either. Door C. Oh, you find an ogre behind the door. So that's Railroad E. And then Quantum Ogre is that, okay, you're in a room. There's door A, door B, door C. Okay, I open door B. Well, there's an ogre behind it. Because you decide sort of it's railroady, but it's called sort of flexible railroady. You make it so that you decided of the order that the player is going to be exposed with the ogre, the trap, and the treasure. Of course, this should be supported by information. If you gave them information that the ogre is behind the yellow door, they should be behind the yellow door, but it's sort of the concept that you adapt your thing, so it's kind of smoothly, you still control the story, but in a loose manner, and of course, it's about doing it in a subtle way.
Yeah, don't tell my players, but that's probably pretty much how I run games in general. But I think, it's really, I think when you're running the game, it's more a matter of hiding those rails or making it feel like the players have agency or making it really feel like their choices matter, because you could run like a totally sandbox game and none of the choices seem to matter, right? I mean, whatever door you open, something happens, but unless it's dramatic or unless it seems to, lead to meaningful consequences, I mean, why are we exploring this dungeon in the first place? Sometimes a railroad adventure can feel pretty like you can still feel like you have an impact. It's more a matter of how you go through the railroad rather than like the particular path that you take. Sometimes it's more about the smaller choices that your character has an opportunity to make along the way that I think can make a story really memorable sometimes.
Yeah, you curate a story for your players, so it's about them having the best experience. And that includes going along with their choice, but also sometimes just not exposing them to something random for the sake of being random if it doesn't serve the purpose or sort of the beat structure or this sort of things. We're getting close to the 1 hour mark. Is there something less you'd like to discuss?
I'd like to thank you for inviting me, on the show. And this has been really fun. one of the things that I didn't talk about so far is that I'm also a event organizer for Adventures League Games on occasion.
Oh, cool.
Mainly for the Eberron Adventures League. Because, like I said, I just really enjoy Eberron as a setting. And the Adventures League campaign that they're writing right now is also really great. And the epics that they wrote for it are, especially the second one, Rolling Thunder, which we ran recently as a smaller epic event here in Korea, as an online event, since, we're still in the midst of COVID right now. It was a smaller event than we'd hoped for, but I think the players who played it really enjoyed it. And so that's another thing that I do sort of on a less regular basis, but something that I like to continue doing as well. And these are also I always try to run those as charity epics as well. And one of the organizations that we try to support regularly is the Korean Unwed Mothers Families Association. And you can find their website at kumfa.or.kr if you're interested. And they're an organization that supports single mothers in South Korea and their families. So with these charity epics, I usually try to support that organization as well. Aside from that, I'm really looking forward to session zero and meeting all the people there. And having a chance to run Riddles of the Cyclopes and the One Page Dungeon by a member of the RPG Creators Club for people at Session Zero. And I'm just so glad to have that opportunity as well.
Great. Well, if there's a place where people can easily find your games on the Adventure League, so because, again, sadly, it's online because you cannot play in person at the Adventure League, but that means that anyone in the world could join one of those games. So I will include, send me a link afterwards. I will include a link to your Facebook in the description of the episode, and I will include any link to your, not only your games, but also anything you organize or where people can find it. Sengjun was posting something, kumfa.or.kr, so I'm gonna include that there. Are there other places where people can find you online when you wish to be found? Did you create that Twitter account yet?
working on it. mainly on my website, just bumly.com. If you type in bumly.com/games, it'll just take you to a page with all my Dungeon Masters Guild games, all the adventures I have on there. I am also, like this year, I am also participating in a number of collaborations as well. I am actually contributing artwork to one of Sangjun's projects, a project called Laureate.
That sounds French.
it's a game of poetry, words of beauty. And so I'm contributing artwork to that. I also contributed some writing to another product that's coming up out in the Dungeon Masters Guild soon. It's called Weird Artifacts I Found in the Guild. So it's a huge tome of 100 artifacts made by a number of different very talented Dungeon Masters Guild authors. So that's you can look for that pretty soon as well. Other than that, I am also contributing to one of the volumes of the Unbreakable series. I can't talk in too much detail about the particular thing that I'm writing for that yet, but I think it's okay for me to mention that I am contributing to it in general. So yeah, that's something else I'm working on. So I'll be posting those on my Facebook. You can just find me on there as well, Bumley Games on my Facebook page. But I'll also be posting those on my website, bumley.com. So yeah, that's the main place where you can find me online.
Great. Well, thanks for joining me. I got too much going on at the moment, but I definitely want to record more stuff with fellow tabletop RPG enthusiast from Korea. I think it was with Sangjun, maybe it was somebody else from Korea, but I've been discussing the possibility of doing a film study, RPG Academy film studies, about a Korean movie or two. I mean, there's so many very good Korean movies to inspire you, tabletop RPG actions. So yeah, we'll definitely have stuff happen. Thanks again for joining me, Bumley, and I look forward to probably running into you at RPGC this weekend.
Yeah, me too.
Cheers, bye.
Have a good night, or have a great day.
Have a good whatever.
Our logo is designed by Roland Kunz. Our theme song is Playtime by Jazar, which you can download on the Free Music Archive. A video version of this episode is available on YouTube. Please consider subscribing to our channel there. Leave us a review on your favorite podcasting platform. If you would like more Café Rollistes, you can also get access to our archive of 100 or so additional episodes via Patreon. If you want to be informed of everything released by the Rollist, we have a monthly newsletter for you to join. And if you want to contribute via the chat room to one of our recordings, subscribe to our Twitch channel and social media accounts to be informed of when streams are happening. Finally, links to everything I just mentioned can be found in the description of this episode. Thanks for listening to us, and remember, you are the Rollist.